Hello, it's Friday, July 17th. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming your way, the investigation is continuing into the motive of a gunman who killed four Marines in Tennessee. We'll take you there. There is hope that an agreement with Iran over its nuclear program will reopen educational opportunities for Iran in the United States. You'll hear about the delegation of U.S. college professors who paid a visit to Tehran. And would you give a ride to a hitchhiking robot? That is a possibility starting today. All that ahead on International Edition. Residents of Chattanooga, Tennessee are stunned today as authorities are trying to determine the motive of a gunman who opened fire on two military facilities Thursday, killing four U.S. Marines in two separate shooting incidents in Chattanooga. Joining us on International Edition is our correspondent, Sharon Bain. She's in Chattanooga. And Sharon, since you've been there, what seems to be the mood? Just paint a little picture for us, if you will.
The mood is really generally one of shock and great sadness. When I was at the memorial this morning where people were laying down flowers and bringing flags and praying, there a lot of people were crying. There was one young man who came and he said, you know, I have nothing to give. But he stood up there and he just sang Amazing Grace and started to cry. He couldn't stop himself. And it was really very moving. And other people would come and they'd set down flowers and they would also have tears in their eyes. And quite a few Vietnam vets came. I think they felt that because these were Marines who had been killed on home ground, that this somehow was, you know, very moving and very touching to them.
Is there any sense of fear that you can determine of maybe something like this being followed up, or do they think this is a solo incident, a separate incident where it's not going to happen again today or tomorrow or whenever?
Several people are saying that they did actually live in fear now. I spoke to one lady, she was a retired personal chef, and she told me, well, you know, I kind of avoid crowded places now. I don't really want to go to crowded places anymore. And I asked the police chief, the Chattanooga police chief, I had a short conversation with him, and I said, you know, are you increasing security? He said, well, there's quite, you know, there are different communities have different fears here. And that they were going to try and address them all and try to make the community feel safe. This is, you know, as you know, this is kind of middle town America. This is not a big urban place. This is a relatively small community. There are different communities within the town. And I think mostly everybody's really in shock.
Sharon Bain, our correspondent in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Thanks, Sharon. Jeff Selden, VOA's national security correspondent, joins us in studio on this story. Jeff, has there been anything, any information about whether this could have been a terrorist act? And everybody's, we hate to say it almost, with an Arab name, the man who is thought to have carried this out, people automatically turn their thoughts to that. Anything whatsoever?
Right now, officials are describing the investigation as an investigation into a possible domestic terrorism incident. And that's as far as they're going right now. As they look into this suspect, 24-year-old Mohammed Yusuf Abdulaziz, who died in the shooting, killed when a police officer returned fire, they're not finding so far very much. They have not, officials say they haven't yet found a huge online presence. The only thing so far coming to light, according to the Site Intelligence Group, which monitors radical behavior online, is that he started a blog just a few days ago, only had two entries in relating both to Islam and teachings of Islam. And at one point, he was quoting something that talked about how life is short and bitter. But beyond that, there's not much. There isn't a lot of Facebook presence or any indication that he had communicated so far with other people. Officials have said there's no indication other people at this point were involved even.
But they have found, at least the reports are saying, that he had made some foreign trips over the past year or so. Is that correct?
They're looking into reports that he did travel overseas, perhaps to Jordan. Remember, he was a naturalized American citizen, but he was a Jordanian who was born in Kuwait. So it's possible he had some ties overseas. overseas, it wouldn't necessarily be unusual for him perhaps to travel overseas for family visits or something like that. And he wasn't on the U.S. terrorism database. He wasn't on that list. His father at one point was on the U.S. terror watch list, but was later removed. But he himself wasn't on the radar. People who talked, who have been interviewed about him, who knew him as he was growing up in Tennessee, talked about how he was, your typical American kid. He was into some martial arts, but he was very tenacious about that, but normally in a good way. He got an engineering degree from the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. And the reports you have, here's just this average guy, and suddenly it seems something changed. What investigators are trying to find out is, what was that something? And again, this is the big concern when it comes to incidents like this, which officials often will call a lone wolf incident, where because of the prevalence of information online, you don't necessarily need to have somebody recruiting you into a terrorist organization. You can self-radicalize. You can find the material yourself. And if you combine that with other circumstances, you can end up with an incident like this that it's very hard for authorities to figure out, A, something was going on, or B, that this person even would have been a likely candidate to try to carry out such an attack.
Well, with the warnings that came from IS, ISIS, whatever you want to call them, known by many names, with instructions to of attacks, especially against uniformed people and military people, there was a higher level of alert at military facilities. Now, what else is the U.S. government doing about this now?
Well, the Department of Homeland Security said yesterday it was enhancing security at various installations as a precaution. The Army chief today talked about how the Army was looking at increasing some security at some of its installations. They already were on heightened alert. There had been warnings about a possible attack or something happening around the July 4th holiday, the Independence Day holiday in the United States. So there was already a heightened sense of alert. What officials are looking at is what more do they need to do, whether or not this is related or is it inspired or if it was directed by some group overseas. Even if there's just a chance of a copycat attack, that's what makes fighting this type of what officials, again, for now are calling domestic terrorism so difficult. In a situation like this, where it may not be part of a bigger plot, where it may just be inspired or self-radicalized, you have the opportunity for copycat attacks. That is perhaps what officials are bracing for. But again, it's still very early on in the investigation. They're probably going to be tracing how he got his weapons, where the weapons came from, who helped him get those weapons. There are lots that investigators have to delve into before the full picture can be completed. And that's why lots of agencies, including the Army, including the Department of Homeland Security, are urging extra precautions.
So far, more questions than there are answers.
With these types of cases, that's usually the way it goes.
Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. Also with us in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palcheski. This has to be somewhere up there as far as what's happening on social media. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And that, as Jeff mentioned, usually the first thing that people look for is social media for the perpetrator of the attack. And we're not seeing a lot of that. But what we are seeing trending are the victims. And those names are starting to come out and they become trending topics on social media. Gunnery Sergeant Thomas Sullivan is 40 years old. He was the first name that came out. He was trending earlier this morning. And as these other names have come out, Skip Wells, 21 years old, just joined the Marines, and David Wyatt. David Wyatt is interesting because it was actually confirmed on Facebook when his wife put up a photo and people started leaving messages of condolence. So social media is certainly playing into that. Those names are becoming trending topics as they're being revealed. Also trending today, we have Eid Mubarak. Of course, it's the end of Ramadan, so millions around the world celebrating Eid. There's also a question whether this attack was timed to the end of Ramadan. Unclear if that's the case, but this topic is trending. Most of what people have been putting on social media for Eid have been peaceful messages, have been celebrating the holiday, so not anything violent on social media with regard to that. And I know that it's been very heavy news a couple of days, so I like to end on kind of some lighter notes.
Please do. Please.
As I mentioned earlier this morning, today's World Emoji Day, so people are going to social media and posting emojis, little smiley faces that you used in text messages. People are putting strings of emojis together to create different book titles or movie titles, to asking people to guess what the movie or book is, so a little game out of that they're doing. And then Hashtag Disneyland60 is trending. It's the 60th birthday of Disneyland, the iconic theme park and cartoon empire in California.
So don't tell me that. I was there the first year it opened. Don't tell me that.
Well, people are posting their memories from the past 60 years. There are a lot of people actually posting tickets. Today's tickets and the tickets on the first day or the first year the park opened, much different. For example, there were no barcodes back then, so the tickets today are much different, and certainly the rides and how people get on them, but people sharing those memories. And
guess what? They were a lot cheaper, too.
I'm sure they were. That's another thing that a lot of people are pointing out as well, for sure.
Andrew, thank you so much. Andrew Palaszewski, look at what's trending today in social media. By the way, I'll bet you didn't know this, that today is the start of the trip across the country, starting in Salem, Massachusetts, of a hitchhiking robot to be traced by social media.
That sounds like it's going to be trending for sure.
You'll hear more about it later in the program. Make sure you stay with us. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman. Coming up, the United States is doing its best to convince some countries that there is merit to the Vienna Agreement reached with Iran. Stay with us. That's up next.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Why does a wailing baby or someone screaming seem to grab our attention and stand out from other sounds, even if we're surrounded by a cacophony of loud noises? An international group of scientists say they've found a key reason why a scream is such an effective form of human communication. They say their research has provided evidence that human screams happen to have its own distinctive acoustic attributes that sets them apart from other sounds. They call the particular attribute that makes a scream so unique roughness, which is a measure of how fast a sound changes in loudness. They found that the more roughness contained within a sound, the more it activated the region of the brain used for processing and remembering fear. The research team thinks that their findings could help designers and manufacturers improve the effectiveness of alarm devices. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're tuned to International Edition. My name is Ira Melman. As you most likely know, the Obama administration is continuing its efforts to sell the Iran nuclear agreement to skeptical allies as diplomats move ahead with their preparations to ratify the deal in the UN Security Council. President Obama met Friday at the White House with the Saudi Foreign Minister Adel Al-Jubeir, whose government is expressing some alarm about the deal with regional rival Iran. International Edition senior Middle East reporter Mohammed Al-Shanawi is following the official statements, and he's talked with experts about the Gulf countries' concerns. Mohammed, what are these concerns that the Gulf countries have about this deal with Iran?
Well, Ira, the experts I spoke to say the Gulf states are mostly concerned that the deal would give Iran over $100 billion in sanctions relief that, in their mind, could shift the regional power balance in Iran's favor. They believe also Tehran might use the money to finance militant groups in places like Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. Here is what Saudi Foreign Minister Adel Jubeir has said after his meeting with Secretary of State John Kerry.
And we hope that the Iranians, if a deal is implemented, that the Iranians will use this deal in order to improve the economic situation in Iran and to improve the lot of the Iranian people and not use it for adventures in the region.
The Saudi foreign minister used that moment to issue a stern warning to Iran. He said, if Iran should try to cause mischief in the region, we are committed to confront it resolutely.
So, Mohammed, President Obama, we hear, is trying to assure these Arab states that the U.S. will support them as they face these regional security challenges?
That's clear, Ira. President Obama repeatedly underscored that the United States is committed as ever to working with Gulf partners to counter Iran's destabilizing activities in the region. And that was reaffirmed again and again by Secretary of State John Kerry.
We are committed to working together to push back against any extremist enterprises, including the activities of Iran in the region, as well as other challenges to security and stability of the region.
Also, IRA Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter is traveling to Saudi Arabia on Tuesday to assure regional leaders about the commitment of the United States to the stability of the whole region.
An all-out push by the Obama administration, huh?
Yeah.
Thanks, Mohammed. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
As the Obama administration here in Washington continues its efforts trying to convince both U.S. lawmakers as well as international doubters around the world to accept the agreement reached in Vienna that was aimed at curtailing Iran's nuclear program in exchange for the lifting of sanctions, there has been an effort underway to reestablish communication and activity between the educational establishments in Iran and the United States. Joining us for an encore performance on International Edition is Daniel Opes. Daniel is the Deputy Vice President for International Partnerships at the Institute for International Education in New York. It was your organization that organized a visit by some American academics to Tehran last month. I think you went along as well. What led to that?
Well, last month, the Institute of International Education led a small delegation of U.S. universities to Iran, because we wanted to explore the opportunities for reestablishing cooperation between higher education institutions.
Well, one would imagine there's still suspicion in both countries, as there is around the world, about any kind of cooperative effort between the U.S. and Iran. Is that posing any problem or problems?
Well, what we found on the delegation was that there is enormous goodwill in Iran towards the United States, and especially in the education space. Because I think what we found is that many of the academics and professors that we met on our trip were actually educated in the U.S., or their children are currently studying in the U.S., so there is a lot of familiarity with the higher education system in the U.S. and a lot of goodwill.
Now, until this agreement is agreed upon, and I'm talking about the one reached in Vienna over the past week or so, can you go forward? Has anything been done? Has any progress been made?
Well, we just came back from our delegation a few weeks ago. We plan to release a white paper later this month, and that white paper will actually lay out some recommendations for what types of educational activities to pursue, but also help U.S. educators and Iranian educators understand what is allowable under the different restrictions.
Daniel Opst is the Deputy Vice President for International Partnerships at the Institute for International Education in New York City. Daniel, once again, thanks for being with us. Always appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Would you pick up a hitchhiker who is really a robot? Well, that is the hope. It has happened before, but not here in the United States. It's happened in Canada. It's happened in Europe. And now a robot will begin his or her journey from Massachusetts across the United States. That's to happen today. Joining us is Franca Zeller. She is one of the creators of what's called Hitchbot. Franca, thanks so much for being with us. Tell us about Hitchbot, will you please?
Well, Hitchbot is a little robot. It's not taller than a child, and it's a helpless robot. So it depends on the help of strangers and human beings.
What's the purpose?
Well, the purpose is, we always say we want to test whether robots can trust humans, but that's a bit, with a twinkle, basically, because as researchers, we do know that the question whether humans can trust robots is a very elementary and important one. But sometimes it makes sense to turn around questions in order to find new insights. And with this experiment, everything is going quite differently than it usually does in human-robot interaction in this area. So it's uncontrolled. We won't follow it. We don't tape anything, so we have no idea how the actual interactions will take place. We leave everything up to the people so they can decide whether they want to interact and they can decide what to do with it.
Also with us is David Harris Smith. He is in charge of the art aspect of Hitchbox. Is that correct, David?
That seems to be my purview, yes.
What are people going to see if and when they see Hitchbot standing or being held up or whatever along the road?
Okay, Hitchbot has what we're calling a yard sale kind of look to it. So if you went down into your basement and somebody gave you the task of not coming up for dinner until you built a robot, that you'd probably have something that looks like Hitchbot. So it's got a bucket for a body, pool noodles for arms and legs, rubber gloves that are stuffed for hands, and it's wearing some Wellington rubber boots.
So tell us about this U.S. trip.
We thought it should travel across the U.S. simply because it has already so many friends here, and people kept telling us via social media, come to the U.S., it will be a fun project here. And so we said, yeah, why not? And there's so much to...
That is Frank Zeller and David Smith. They are the co-creators of Hitchbot, who starts his U.S. journey today in Salem, Massachusetts. Thanks so much for being with us today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. My name is Ira Melman. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Iraqi government has announced it is leading a major military push to retake Iraq's Anbar province from ISIL, which controls two of the province's major cities, Ramadi and Fallujah. Clearing ISIL from Anbar is no easy task. As President Barack Obama recently noted, ISIL has dug in among innocent civilian populations in the urban areas under its control. But as local forces take on ISIL militarily, it is also important for ISIL sympathizers in Iraq, Syria, and beyond to hear the stories of those who were once attracted to the propaganda promulgated by ISIL, but who have come to reject it. As President Obama has said, to ultimately defeat terrorist groups like ISIL, it is necessary to discredit their ideology, the twisted thinking that draws vulnerable people into their ranks. Who can do that better than those who have seen it from the inside at close quarters? Take, for example, a former ISIL fighter from Fallujah known as Hamza, who volunteered to join ISIL last summer, but who defected after 6 months. He told the Independent newspaper he joined the group for religious reasons, but was appalled by the beheadings, by being asked to execute Sunnis whom he knew, and by being offered captured young Yazidi women for sexual pleasure. At the beginning, I thought they were fighting for Allah, but later I discovered they were far from the principles of Islam, he said. The justice they were calling for when they first arrived in Fallujah turned out to be only words. Or the Syrian teenager Youssef Barho, recruited by ISIL to be a suicide bomber, who eventually gave himself up to Iraqi authorities. He told the New York Times last year he joined ISIL willingly because he believed in Islam and had been convinced by ISIL that if he didn't join the group, Shiites would come and rape his mother. Soon, however, he said, I noticed things that were different from Islam. He noted, for example, that ISIL inflicted severe punishments on men in the city who were caught smoking cigarettes. Yet in camp, he saw fighters smoking. He witnessed homosexual encounters between the fighters, and he became increasingly disturbed by the killing of innocent people. President Obama has said that the international fight against ISIL is a battle against terrorists who distort Islam and whose victims are mostly Muslims. Those who have experienced ISIL firsthand and have turned away say the same.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.